Chapter 6
"Yes," Tharkay said, "I am looking for the smugglers."
They had walked a short distance into the trees, pressing down the undergrowth. Pebbles shifting underfoot and the creak of branches pushed aside assured them no one should be following without their hearing it.
"The East India Company," Tharkay continued, "is losing some £50,000 per annum to their work, and they fear worse to come, much worse. So far the illegal trade is only a trickle, but it is a steady trickle they cannot close up, and widening."
Lawrence nodded.
"And the goods are not coming in by sea?"
"More to the point," Tharkay said, "the goods are not leaving by Canton."
Lawrence stared.
"You begin to understand the degree of their concern, I think."
"How can they be certain?" Lawrence said. "The port is fantastically busy. Some shipments must be able to evade their monopoly."
Tharkay said,
"When the smuggling first began to be noticed, a little more than a year ago, word was sent to the officers in Canton to make a note of all ships coming through the port, with the intention of tracing the source. Similar efforts have been made before, of course, although they were puzzled by a method so indirect as funneling the goods through Sydney."
"The operation must eat nearly all the profit of it," Lawrence said.
"So they imagined," Tharkay said, "and did not at first take it very seriously. They expected to find at the bottom of it only some enthusiast who was willing to spend a pound to save sixpence. There is very little which inspires creativity so much as government tariffs and licenses. But the ships and their cargo are accounted for, nearly every one. There are a handful of cases," he shrugged a little, dismissing these, "nothing which could account for the steady flow of goods, which is only increasing."
"They fear, then, that the Chinese have opened another port," Lawrence said. "To some other nation?"
"Perhaps not officially," Tharkay said, "but if the officials of some poor city should choose to turn a blind eye to the occasional foreign vessel, for instance, if they should be persuaded by one with sympathy for some foreign nation—"
"Lien," Lawrence said immediately, "and Napoleon would care nothing for the profit, not so long as he could undermine our trade."
Tharkay nodded.
"It all fits together very nicely," he said. "The French funnel cheap goods to our markets, undercutting the East India Company."
Trade was Britain's lifeblood. It bore the cost of the merchant marine, which trained her seamen and her shipbuilders. It brought in the gold and silver which funded her allies, and put armies on the continent to stand in the way of Bonaparte's dominion.
"If prices fell badly enough, they might cause a panic in the exchange," Lawrence said. "But would anyone in China risk so obliging Lien?"
She had been disgraced in China with the death of her former companion, Prince Yongqing. He had been chief of that conservative faction which had preferred to have nothing to do with the nations of the West, either in commerce or in politics. They had schemed to supplant Crown Prince Mianning, himself privately a sympathizer with the more liberal slant of his court, their design having been uncovered and thwarted, and Yongqing himself slain. Lien had chosen exile in France, divorcing herself from her former home in hopes of finding Napoleon an effective instrument of revenge. Tharkay shrugged.
"You know as well as do I the reverence with which celestials are viewed, and Yongqing's political allies were only defeated, not eradicated. In the intervening years they may have regrouped."
"It seems just the sort of thing Lien would do," Temeraire said, shaking his tendrils free of water, having drunk his fill, and enjoying the sentiment of righteous disdain. "She and Yongqing were so angry that China should have any trade with the West, and try to do so many wicked things all in the name of preventing it, and now she has changed her notion and is looking for more."
Lawrence paused and doubtfully said,
"I had not considered that her philosophy was so opposed to opening the borders of China, in its principles. It is incongruous, a little."
Then fell silent.
"That is just what I mean," Temeraire said. "She is perfectly happy to throw all of that over, if only it will hurt us. Just her sort of unpleasantness. Lawrence, I do not mean to complain," he added, "for this water is very nice, so fresh and crisp, but I am hungry."
Tharkay's little creek had led them with only half an hour's flight to the river into which it merged, wide and clear, and lined along both banks with tall, tall pines. The river flowed in the wrong direction for their needs, south towards Sydney instead of away, and anyway it was full of rocks and very shallow in places, but there was room to walk along its banks, and Tharke was of the opinion that if they should follow it upstream, they might well find it beginning somewhere in a pass on the other side of the mountains. Temere thought it an excellent idea to stay close to the river. In any case, one grew so very parched, much more quickly than one might have expected. And then, of course, there was Caesar. He cast a disgusted look over. Caesar had needed to be carried to the river, even after they had given him 2 canteens full of water, and told him there was more to be had, even more cool and refreshing. It had not stirred him to make any effort. He had only said, "I don't care to fly just yet. Temere may take me," in the most casual way, and sighed even when asked to climb up onto Temere's back. And when they had finally brought him to the river, he had climbed down and, before anyone could stop him, walked straight on off the bank to immerse himself. So everyone else who wished to drink or to fill a canteen had to use a less convenient place further upstream. Even the poor, sick convict Jonas Green had done better. He had roused up quite heroically when given a full cup, and said, "Damn me, if I will die after all! Let me have some more!" And although he trembled dreadfully when he tried to stand, he hobbled over with 2 men helping him, and sat by the bank until he had managed to wash himself all over, and his wretchedly stinking clothing also, all of which he spread beside him on some flat stones, in the sunlight, to dry. Caesar, on the other hand, had to be reminded to drink, and then not allowed to drink too much, and then prodded sharply to get out of the water so others might bathe, even though he was so small yet that a little while lying in the river had sufficed to see him clean. He had sighed and hinted that he wanted scrubbing, when all he needed to do was flatten himself a little to have the water rush over his back with no help. Rankin had at once ordered several of the convicts to oblige him, which meant they were all tired and disinclined to help when Temeraire wished to be bathed a little too, and needed someone to carry buckets up to his back to pour the water over. Temeraire sighed and made the best of what Demain and Roland could do, meanwhile dabbling his nose in the deepest part of the river, and tipping his head up so the water would run down his back.
"You might wash down the eggs, too," he added, "with a soft rag, if you please, and not very hard, only to be sure the shells are clean."
Lieutenant Forthing was very quick to join in this work, Temeraire noted disapprovingly, and made sure to keep close watch upon him, and ensure Forthing did not try and speak to the eggs, to make them any inappropriate promises, or brag of himself.
"That is enough. It is clean, so you may have done," Temeraire said, when Forthing had wiped away the dust on the large egg, the yellow reaper.
He was not so eager to linger while working on the very little one, at least.
"Temeraire,"
Tharke said to him, when they had all drunk their fill and settled for a comfortable rest in the shade, while the sun worked past its height,
"do you see any signs of fire along the river, more distantly?"
Temeraire did not mind leaping aloft for a little while, now there was water, and hovering looked as closely as he could in either direction, so far as he could see before the river twisted out of sight around a curve and plunged away into a canyon the other way, but there was no sign of any person at all.
"And also," he said, coming back down, "I am sorry to say, no sign of any game. I hope I have not been too ungrateful about the kangaroos."
"That may make us a little uncomfortable, but it is some encouragement to me if the game has been frightened off,"
Tharke said, and turned towards the camp.
"So you propose to erect a road alongside the river," Rankin was saying to Lawrence, "which will meander in every direction to the certain unnecessary expense of 20 miles out of 50, no doubt, and having been built in the midst of summer and drought, will be flooded the first rains, and this before we have even traced it to its conclusion."
"Captain Rankin,"
Lawrence said, in that very level and restrained way which meant he was particularly angry,
"if you have uncovered a more certain passage overnight, I would be glad to hear of it. In the meantime, we are charged to build a road."
"We are not charged to waste our days wandering in an uncomfortable wilderness to no good purpose, sitting idly by and shepherding these men along to we know not what end," Rankin said, "and I have made use of a night's reflection to better comprehend what any one of sense," he stressed pointedly, "might have observed from our flights yesterday. There is no reason why these gorges should make a passage at all, and as they evidently choose to collapse at very little provocation, even if we should find one, we could not rely on its perpetuity. We are wandering in a maze that has no exit. We had far better go up on the heights and find a crossing along the ridges."
"So that every cow can be marched 1,000 feet into the air and 1,000 feet down again before they come to market," Grandy said. "Precious clever sort of route that would make."
The day was just as stifling and unpleasant, and they were all hungry and inclined to argue. As they did not mean to walk any further at present, there was nothing else to do, and it was too hot even to sleep.
"Seems to me we might stay by the water and be comfortable,"
Jack Telly said, never shy of putting in his own opinion.
"Much to no one's surprise," Rankin snapped, "I imagine we would see 2 hours work in a day, and the rest spent in idling and drunken stupors."
Temeraire, for his part, privately thought that at least the ridges being so much higher would be cooler and more pleasant. One might have a chance of some wind, and at least one would not be staring into these rock walls on every side, so confining. But of course he would not say anything which might support Rankin, who did not deserve such a mark of distinction. As he had made the suggestion, it could be of no use whatsoever.
"May I propose," Tharkay said, "that when the sun has eased, we instead follow the course of the river to its culmination, and see what advantage this route affords. We need not immediately begin construction."
This seemed quite sensible, but Rankin did not answer Tharkay, and indeed he turned his back, without a word, and walked away to sit with Caesar. Not even the slightest inclination of his head to acknowledge he had been spoken to, and Tharkay had not been the least bit impolite.
"I do not understand what business Rankin has, behaving so rudely,"
Temeraire said to Lawrence afterwards, while they began to collect the baggage once again.
"None, although I imagine he takes Tharkay's descent for his excuse,"
Lawrence said, looking up the course of the river.
"You're quite sure you saw no one on the banks?"
he asked.
"If you should see anyone, we will be glad to speak the natives, if they were the singers last night. They might well be able to tell us if we have taken a reasonable route."
"No, there was no one. But I will certainly look again when we are up,"
Temeraire said, remembering belatedly the odd music. He had been so very drowsy and uncomfortable last night that it had all seemed very nearly a dream, or at least far away.
"That was a very interesting kind of song. I have never heard anything like, or that language at all. But whatever about Tharkay's descent can Rankin object to? After all, it is not as though he were not hatched yet, and no one knows what he might turn out to be."
"His mother was Nepalese," Lawrence said, "and there was some irregularity about the marriage, I understand. I find Rankin is given to think a great deal of birth, and not enough of character."
He did not try to keep quiet. He and Granby were inclined to resent Rankin's insult, and Temeraire did not mind joining them in the sentiment. So everyone was very stiff and formal as they packed everything up. Caesar sighed heavily and made many reluctant noises about flying, and let his head and tail and wings drag limp towards the ground as he pushed himself up, and then Dorset went over and examined him and said,
"He may fly, but he shall carry no weight. He may not ride, Captain Rankin."
Caesar sat back on his haunches and said,
"I can carry him. He is my captain,"
indignantly, all signs of limp torpor gone in a flash. But Dorset was implacable, so Temeraire would have to endure carrying Rankin again, and Lawrence did not look at all pleased either. To add insult to injury, when Lawrence quietly inquired further, Dorset said,
"No, no, he is capable of carrying, perfectly capable, but he is bidding fair to develop into a malingerer, and an early lesson such as this is like to have a good effect."
For his part, Temeraire thought that correcting Caesar's bad habits were so thoroughly lost a cause that he could not justify any such efforts, when they led to a situation so unpleasant to other innocent parties. But Lawrence did not like to contradict a surgeon. So up Rankin came again, boarding with Lawrence at the very end because of his rank, and as a guest. And instead Tharkay went to fly with Iskirka, which did not suit anyone except her. Though Tharkay was not his, precisely, Temeraire had grown used enough to his company to feel a sense of some responsibility, a degree of justified interest. And Tharkay could not in the least prefer to ride upon Iskirka, who was exceedingly hot and damp in her person, and so unreliable. They had been working in the hot sun so that when it dropped again below the gorge walls, they were ready to take advantage of the chance and to fly onward at once. It was not pleasant flying, despite the lack of direct sun. They had to keep close within the narrow canyon walls, uninteresting and covered with scrubby, dried-out grass and shrubs gone pale as wheat. The river running over the rocks had a strange, steady noise, not loud enough to be called a roar. It seemed more a part of the same queer silence which seemed to envelop the gorges. It was not a sound one could listen to. It rather wished to swallow up all other noises, so Temeraire could scarcely even hear his own wings beating. Caesar kept insisting on flying too close, where he could keep an eye on Rankin, even though it was his own fault he was not allowed to carry his own captain, and as though anyone else would have wanted Rankin anyway, Temera thought. Caesar would clip him, coming too close to the wings, and once he even fouled Temera's wing joint with the tip of one claw. Temera had been drifting a little, almost sleeping as he flew. The scratch startled him unpleasantly aware again, and conscious of his surroundings.
"Ow!" he said sharply. "That is quite enough. You will keep further off if you cannot mind where you are putting your claws," he added, and snapped at Caesar's tail for warning.
Caesar tipped his wings back and dodged hastily, but took the lesson and made a little more of a safe distance between them. Temera settled himself back into the tedium of long flying, but in so doing noticed a flash of colour below.
"Lawrence," he said, looking over his shoulder, as he paused, hovering, "I think that is a bit of broken plate there, if I am not mistaken."
"Whatever is of interest in some flotsam," Rankin said.
Lawrence asked Temera to set them down, and when Iskierka had come down also, he and Tharke considered the fragments. It was certainly a very lovely example of Qing Bai ware, broken up. A sad waste, Temera thought, and the smugglers had ought to have been more careful. They went aloft again afterwards, flying quite low, where they might be shaded from the sun. The river curved away from them, upstream into a series of gorges, and Temera had settled it in his own head they would be flying until nightfall, when he made the last turn, and stopping abruptly nearly made Iskierka and Caesar both pile into him. They could not hover as he did.
"What are you doing?" Iskierka demanded, and then beating up over him said, "Oh, there!"
with immense satisfaction, as though she had done anything useful to bring them to this point. The river plunged on through the trees below them, but up ahead the timber petered out, and a broad field of rich green growth, very small, spread out across the floor of a wide green valley, framed but not cramped by rising mountains. There was a murmur of pleasure and satisfaction among all the men.
"I have rarely seen such a splendid farming country," Lawrence said to Temera, "or at least so it looks."
Temera himself was far more preoccupied with the startling evidence they had not been the first to make the crossing after all. Before him, in the field, stood a small and placid herd of cattle, their coats gone shaggy and ragged, munching upon the grass.